If you want to find a modern hot button issue that causes a severe and volatile reaction, discuss the biblical position on sex and human sexuality. Out of the list of 10 problems that we are covering in this series, this one seems to be the one that causes the most visceral response and visceral reactions. The issue of sexuality and the moral stance the Bible takes polarizes people. This is one of those issues that Christians, and especially younger generations of Christians, struggle with the most. They face a huge backlash from their peers over what many say is an old-fashioned, antiquated perspective that is out of touch with our modern reality. Planned Parenthood has openly said that Christians are censors who have an agenda that promotes the suppression of natural instincts and urges. Atheist scholars believe that there can and should be no legitimate discussion with anyone who holds a moral view of sex. Simply put, Christians or any other religious group have no place speaking in the modern age on the topic of sex or sexuality. That's a very difficult position to deal with. This is not a case of disagreeing with someone's particular position or opposing a moral position. This is saying there's not a single thing Christians or the Bible can offer to any discussion on sex. That's a harsh position. Many skeptics don't mind discussing some of the other problems. Creationism, whether Jesus was a real guy or someone invented by the church, the problem of the Bible's reliability. But the problem of the Bible's position on sexuality is not a topic that many skeptics believe is worthy of a conversation. Why do you suppose that is? Out of all the things that could be a problem, things that people have issue with, why is sex an issue that people feel is not something the Bible can speak to? Why is it that the culture does not give any credibility to what God and His Word says about human sexuality? Now, this position actually goes for probably some people in church as well. There are some Christians who believe or allow the Bible to shape their decisions on compassion and caring for the hurting and the outcast. They like what the Bible says about treating others with respect and being kind to others. They don't even get as wound up when you talk about being generous with our finances. But so many people draw the line at this issue. How come? Why is that so? Well, there are two main reasons why so many are not willing to listen to what the Bible has to say about sex. Number one is it interferes with our rights as individuals. If there is a mantra or a slogan that could be attributed to our modern culture, it might very well be, "I know my rights." That might be the tagline for the current culture. Starting way back in the 1700s during the Enlightenment period, the greatest thing it was believed that anyone could obtain was personal freedom. Freedom to choose and self-determine one's own destiny and path in life, to obtain ultimate autonomy, is the greatest goal and the highest good anyone can achieve. Fulfilling that goal is seen as a higher state of enlightenment, progressive and healthy society. The reason that people have such an issue with the Bible's position on sex is that it puts limits on what an individual should do with their own body. In a culture that holds autonomy and individual rights as paramount, this goes against the grain. It's seen as a violation of their basic human rights to decide for themselves what they can and cannot do. To say, "No, you shouldn't do that," or "This is the only option you have," is not something this culture or this society agrees with. The culture believes that the individual alone is able to decide what's right and wrong for them, what they can and cannot do. I believe the culture would be more accepting if God simply gave us more options. If God's moral stance on sex, if it offered a few more options for us, the culture might be more willing to go along. We like to have choices. We like to have choices on our TV. 450 channels on cable isn't enough. We need Netflix, Amazon Prime, we need Hulu, we need Apple TV. We want choices. We like choices, and limiting our choices is now seen as an attempt to hinder our independence or our sovereignty. Only having one option for purchasing your produce or your meat is seen as a monopoly, and that is unacceptable in our culture. We want choices. We've seen this core value in our culture. We've seen it impact our entertainment. We've seen it impact our shopping. But it's made its way into social areas as well. It is looked on as unreasonable to expect people to get married and stay married to one person for their entire life. And it's unreasonable to expect that one sexual partner they have be their spouse. It's viewed as abhorrently restrictive. When it comes to sex, the culture bristles at the idea that they should not be permitted to do whatever, whenever, and with whoever they want. The second reason why sex is such a big obstacle that keeps people from a relationship with God is the misconception that the Bible is anti-sex. An assumption that has been made and is being made by the majority of the culture is that the Bible and God wants to restrict our sexual activity because God is a killjoy. That God doesn't want us to have any fun. He's anti-pleasure. When it comes to sex, this clip explains how the culture sees God. It's quick, so pay attention.
Boy, he really sucks the fun out of everything, doesn't he?
Fun sucker!
That's how the culture views God when it comes to sex. Fun sucker! The assumption that God and the Bible are anti-sex is just plain wrong. God is very pro-sex. God is the designer of sex. He made and designed humans to enjoy the sexual experience. He designed it to be more than just a momentary physical encounter, however. It was never designed to be a momentary experience between two autonomous individuals, but rather two individuals becoming one and experiencing all the pleasures of sex that God built into their bodies. Believing that God and the Bible are anti-sex is not based on fact. It is not based on truth, but on a bad assumption. I want to speak to those of you who live in that belief. I challenge you to listen very closely to this message. And beyond this, I want you to do a little bit of research. I want you to look into this. Yes, your pastor is telling you to research sex. If you believe that God is anti-sex, it cannot be because you have read his word and what it says about sex. Unfortunately, the reason most people have come to this understanding of God's view of sex is because they have lazily just gone along with what the culture says. The culture has fed us a story based on poor assumptions. And this has formed many people's incorrect view of God and sex. For the rest of today's message, I want to look at three other misconceptions about sex, beyond the fact that God is anti-sex. Three other ideas that exist in the culture that do not line up with what God actually says about sex. Three cultural perspectives on sex that are not consistent with the truth. Now, these aren't new issues. These are issues that have existed for thousands of years. These three social issues have been woven into how we view sex and can be a problem for us that keeps us from a full understanding and relationship with Jesus. The three incorrect views of sex I want to cover are sex is God, or sex is only an appetite to be satisfied, and that sex is bad. Now, sex is God and sex as appetite are views of sex that are birthed in the culture. They were birthed inside the culture. Christians would most recognize those or identify those as being evidence of our fallen nature. It's evidence of sin. Now, the incorrect perception that sin is bad has found its way into the culture because of the church. Let me get this straight. Let me understand this. This idea that sex is bad did not come from the culture. It came from the church. If you grew up in a church like I did, if you've always been in church, if and when a pastor or a youth leader talked about sex, it could usually be summed up in these three categories. Number one, sex before you're married is sin. Number two, sex outside of marriage is sin. And number three, defining where the sex line was so you could know exactly what activities you could participate in before it was sin. Those are the three categories that were covered when it came to sex in church as I grew up. Now, here's a quote from Mark Clark, author of Problem of God, that sums up what I learned about sex from church. He says, sex is dirty, nasty, vile, and wrong, so save it for the one you love. Now, I've come to believe that the church has come a long way in how it deals with the biblical view of sex. Unfortunately, we are still way behind the culture. The culture is far ahead of us with knowing what it believes. The culture is solid. It has a solid position on sex. The message that the culture has been sharing is well entrenched in people's hearts and minds. They know what they believe in the culture, and they teach it every day to whomever will listen. The church and Christians are not sure what they believe, and much of what they do believe does not line up with the actual word of God. Clement of Alexandria, a respected Christian teacher in the 2nd and 3rd centuries, taught that sex was for the purpose of procreation only. Sex outside of making babies was a sin. In the 4th and 5th centuries, some church leaders taught that before the fall, Adam and Eve couldn't have sex, so that sex was a result of sin. Now, there's a valid reason why the church is viewed as being anti-sex, or the source of misconceptions that sex is bad, because we taught that. We taught people that sex was bad. By telling people things that were not true, or more recently, only focusing on the negative side of sex, we have delivered a message loud and clear. It may not have been an intentional message. We may not have done it on purpose, but we have communicated the message that sex is a bad thing. Parents that are afraid to discuss sex with their kids out of fear that that will make them sexually active. Pastors and leaders who are afraid to deal with tough sexuality issues because they're afraid of some backlash. Individuals who never take the time to read what the Bible actually says about sex and instead just continue believing whatever it is they've been taught from back in the day. All of these approaches to the issue of sex help perpetuate the myth that sex is a bad thing. Now, I understand that being a parent in this hypersexual culture where sex sells everything and anything, where special interest groups want not just to push the boundaries, but obliterate any sort of boundary. I understand that's difficult. This is a tough place to try and help your kids learn and understand what the scriptures say about sex. School curriculums are increasingly covering this issue of sexuality, and I could say never address it from a biblical perspective. Now, the natural emotion for parents and leaders is to feel fear, anxiety, apprehension when these things come up. Our knee-jerk reaction to this situation to counteract the culture is to go to the opposite extreme, to either ignore the issue or speak strictly on the negative side of sex, just to balance things out. Let me tell you, that's not the right strategy. How do I know? Excellent question. You ask such good questions. That's an excellent question. The answer is found in 1 Corinthians. If there is ever a poster child for the messed up church, the Corinthian church, the church in Corinth, would probably be the picture listed in the dictionary. Troubled church, Corinth. One of the biggest things they had to deal with in that church, one of their biggest struggles, was sexual immorality. The city of Corinth was a wealthy city. It was a rich town. People had lots of money. They could afford anything and everything. And they wanted to enjoy all the pleasures that were allowed to them. This was a place where almost anything sexual was acceptable. Now, here's something important for you to remember. When Paul writes these letters to the church of Corinth, 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, he is not writing to the people of Corinth. This is not a letter to the editor addressed to all the people there. His letter is to the church of Corinth. He is talking to people who call themselves followers of Christ. Now, the people of this church lived in a hyper-sexualized culture that had become a part of the church. Paul needed to address some issues, things like Christian orgies, men sleeping with their father's wives. You know, just your average sexual debauchery. That's what Paul was having to deal with in this church. These were people doing really, really horrible things. Things that even the community of Corinth said were coming close to the line. Close to what was acceptable. If anyone could have taken a negative tone on sex, it would have been Paul to these people. The Apostle Paul could have been excused from not either covering this topic or being harsh. He could have easily preached a message or wrote a letter that said, stop the sex, sex is dirty. Run away from sex, it's dangerous. We could understand if Paul avoided this tough topic and swept it under the rug, but he doesn't do that. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 3-6. Here's what he says to the people in this church. The husband should fulfill his wife's sexual needs, and the wife should fulfill her husband's needs. The wife gives authority over her body to her husband, and the husband gives authority over his body to his wife. Do not deprive each other of sexual relations unless you both agree to refrain from sexual intimacy for a limited time so you can give yourselves more completely to prayer. Afterward, you should come together again so that Satan won't be able to tempt you because of your lack of self-control. I say this as a concession, not as a command. Instead of running from the issue, instead of sharing a negative perspective on sex, Paul runs right into the middle of the issue. He leans into it. He said, married people should have sex often. Paul does not say that the main purpose of sex is making babies. He says, do it because it's fun and God designed it that way to enjoy. He says, enjoy what God has made. God made sex for us to enjoy with our spouses. And Paul clearly states that to avoid sex is damaging to our bodies and our relationship as married couples. Enjoy sex with your husband or wife. That's something the Bible strongly encourages. But Pastor, be honest. Everybody knows that married sex is boring. The only people that have good sex are single people. The ones that can pick a new partner when they get bored and things feel old. Friends with benefits is the way to go, they say. You can have your committed relationship, but to fully enjoy a sexual experience, you really need to try some different flavors. Baskin and Robbins has more than one or two. Well, that's the way popular thinking. And the media presents the idea of sex. These people who are having fun with sex, the people who are really enjoying it, are most certainly not following God's plan of having sex only with one spouse. People that are following God's plan, which is one man and one woman in a committed relationship, are not having good sex. Is that really true, though? Do single people have better sex lives than married ones? Another excellent question. You ask such good questions. I love it when you ask good questions. In a recent study, the Case for Marriage, researchers investigated that very issue. Who was happier and more satisfied with their lives, married or single people? This is what the study found about the satisfaction levels of singles versus married couples. 40% of married people have sex 2 times a week. Only 20% of single or cohabitating people said they do. 40% of married women and 50% of married men said that their sex life was physically and emotionally satisfying, compared to 30% of single cohabitating women and 38% of men. Another study completed by the University of Chicago and the State University of New York, which has been described as the most authoritative study ever on sexuality, published these results. The most sexually active people, the most physically pleased and emotionally satisfied people, were married people, not single people. How could that be? How could married people be having more satisfied sex than the free-living singles or people who haven't entered into the fun-sucking relationship, constricting, old-fashioned institution of marriage? How is that possible? Another good question. Well, there's two easy-to-understand reasons why married people have better sex. Number one, good sex is hard work, and we need time to get it right. And getting the most out of sex requires an exclusive relationship. Now, this may or may not be something you already knew, but women are a bit more complicated than men, especially when it comes to the physiology and the psychology of sex. Men are fairly straightforward when it comes to sex and pleasure. You women should just stop laughing right now. We men know and can communicate to our wives exactly what makes our engines roar. For women, the process of learning about what they like or don't like is a learned process. It takes time for them to understand what makes them tick sexually, and then it takes time to teach their partner. This is really difficult when you aren't in a committed relationship that has the level of buy-in that comes with marriage. It's just too hard to do. I could spend plenty of time on this, but I want to briefly cover the other worldviews of sex that are at odds with the biblical worldview. The idea that sex is bad is an incorrect assumption. And next is, sex is God. The simplest way to describe this worldview is that it's the polar opposite of sex is bad. Sex is bad is on this side, sex is God is on this side. Whereas sex is bad wants to suppress sexual urges because they are troubling or difficult, sex is God says that experiencing sexual pleasure is the greatest accomplishment and the highest achievement anyone can ever have. Now, because of that, any sexual urge that you have should be fully explored and enjoyed. You should deny yourself nothing. To not fully explore any and all sexual urges means you will not be your best self. It means you will not be all that you can be. If we want to be as emotionally and physically healthy, satisfied, and achieve our highest level of development, we should enjoy any and all sexual experiences that we can. That's the basic premise of sex as God. Margaret Sanger, an American nurse, reformer, and sex educator who first coined the phrase birth control, describes the philosophy like this: sexual liberation is the only method to find inner peace, security, and beauty. In this worldview, sex becomes much more than a physical act. It becomes something that liberates, something that sets free people from bondage, brings them to a higher state of awareness. It becomes a religious experience, almost salvation. Alfred Kinsey, in his study, Sexual Behavior in the Human Male, says that the classifications of sexual behavior into normal or abnormal is in itself wrong. Sex is a biological function and is acceptable in whatever way it happens. Now, if that's the case, the biblical view of sex, which means one man and one woman for life, is the only sexual expression, interferes with us becoming our best selves. This is something that the people of Jesus' day were dealing with as well. Sexual immorality, premarital sex, temple prostitutes, sexual slavery, extramarital sex, and promiscuity were common then. Now, that's not to say that things haven't gotten worse. You see, for the first time in history, the access to sex has gotten so easy that now many people, specifically young men, would prefer to stay at home and watch porn on their computer than go to all the trouble to have an actual physical sexual relationship. The sex as God worldview and its promotion of sex above all else has caused a significant portion of the current generation to believe sex is reduced to getting physical pleasure with or without a partner. That's the state of our culture. That's where sex as God has gotten us to. The third common worldview on sex that does not line up with God's plan is sex is appetite. When we're hungry, we eat food. When we're thirsty, we get a drink. Lots of different foods and lots of different drinks. When our girls were growing up, their idea of food was whatever they could cook the quickest. That was usually Campbell's tomato soup and chicken strips that you could cook in the oven. The point was, your body gets hungry, so you feed it. There is no moral issue for most meal choices. You don't usually ask a moral question before you eat dinner. No one has to answer whether it's right or wrong to eat lunch. Sex is appetite, says our sexual desires are simply another appetite that needs to be fed. It isn't a moral question, so why consider if it's right or wrong? Because it's just a hunger that needs to be fed. In Jesus' day, the Greeks believed that there was a separation between your body and your spirit, and the two were disconnected. Your body was generally thought to be bad. Your spirit was generally believed to be good. One did not affect the other. You could do something with your body that did not affect your spirit. So there was a disconnect between what those people believed happened with their body and their spirit. Stay with me here. This is going to get a little weirder. Naturalists, people who believe that there is no God and that man evolved from lower forms, believe we have no spirit. There is nothing beyond what we can see. There is no God and therefore no spiritual component to man. This means sex is just a physical act and nothing else. So there's the view that the physical act is not connected to our spirit, or there's the view that we don't have a spirit, so the physical act has no impact on that because there isn't any. So if you're still with me, here is where it gets really weird. If naturalists are correct, or if the Greeks were correct that there's a disconnect, then follow their logic that there is no spiritual or moral connection between our body and our spirit or sex. It leads to some very, very shocking conclusions like this. If sex is only a physical matter and not moral or spiritual, sex across species barriers ceases to be an offense to our status quo and dignity as human beings. Let me read that again. If there is no physical connection with our spirit And no moral or spiritual question, sex across species barriers ceases to be an offense to our status quo and dignity as human beings. Which is a direct quote from an article written by a Princeton University professor, Peter Singer, a follower of Darwin's theory of evolution. Another result of this line of thinking that will shock you is found in an article titled, Why Men Rape, published by the New York Academy of Sciences. Rape, it says, is an evolutionary adaptation for maximizing reproductive success. Similar to leopard spots, it is a byproduct of our need to ensure our survival. This is where that kind of thinking leads you to. Now, I would assume that most people who would ascribe to the theory of evolution never follow the logic all the way through to this end. But that's where the logic leads. Sex is not about us feeding our animal nature, however, simply feeding another appetite. Something that is disconnected from a deeper spiritual part of us as individuals. If that was the case, when someone was sexually assaulted, when someone was raped, the minute the rape was over, the pain would stop. But we know that's not the case. We know that's not the case. If you're a victim of sexual abuse, if you're a victim of sexual assault, you know the pain goes on and on and on. If it was only physical, that wouldn't be so. There is a spiritual and emotional connection when it comes to sex. This is the point the Bible makes in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 12 to 16. It says, you say I'm allowed to do anything, but not everything is good for you. And even though I am allowed to do anything, I must not become a slave to anything. You say food was made for the stomach and the stomach for food. This is true, though someday God will do away with both of them. That's a sad thing. I like food. Anyway, that's just a freebie. But you can't say that our bodies were made for sexual immorality. They were made for the Lord, and the Lord cares about our bodies. And God will raise us from the dead by his power, just as he raised our Lord from the dead. Don't you realize that your bodies are actually parts of Christ? Should a man take his body, which is part of Christ, and join it to a prostitute? Never. And don't you realize that if a man joins himself to a prostitute, he becomes one body with her? For the scriptures say, the two are united into one. If I had been thinking, I would have done this for you to actually show you. I remember doing this. Every time I talked about this with students when I was in youth ministry, I would always take two pieces of white paper and glue them together at the beginning of the service with some good white glue, and I would let it sit there. And at the end of the service, after I talked about this point, about joining two into one, I would encourage students to come and try and separate those two pieces of paper after the glue had dried. It was impossible. You could separate them, but you always left a piece of one piece of paper on the other. You could not separate them cleanly. When you tore them apart, there were pieces mixed over. That's what God's talking about here. When we're involved in a sexual relationship, you make a spiritual connection with another person. There's an emotional connection, like there is no other human connection. There's nothing else like it. Sex was intended to bind you to your spouse, transforming you from two individuals to one. God is not anti-sex. Look at Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 5. Look at the instructions to a young man. A newly married man must not be drafted into the army or be given any other official responsibilities. He must be free to spend 1 year at home bringing happiness to the wife he has married. That's serious. Read Proverbs chapter 5. Read the entire book of the Song of Songs. Find out what God thinks about sex. Following God's design for sex does not mean we get to do whatever we want, whenever we want, with whoever we want. But following the designer plans for sex means we have the best experience possible. Instead of feeling restricted by God's plan, we should focus on the fact that all the best things, all the healthiest things for us in life require discipline. They require focus. They require commitment. God's plan for us and our sexuality follows the same path. That should not be a restriction to us. It should be liberating and encouraging to us. Let's stand together this morning.